That was a lot more pressure on Matt than he was expecting. Thanks, Matt. Yeah, let's give Matt a little bit of love here. Thank you, Matt. So there's a lot of different ways to approach Good Friday. It comes around every year, and it's kind of like Easter Sunday, that you know what we're going to be talking about. You've possibly heard something about what happens on this day before. And yet, it also kind of offers us an opportunity to press more deeply in, maybe to slow down, maybe to even observe or to talk about something which you have not had a chance to explore. So in that vein, as we as a whole church network were thinking, talking, praying about Good Friday, where we found our attention being drawn was to this table, the table that we often refer to as communion, but this table that you may also hear referred to as the Last Supper. And in case your brain, there's a lot of Christian jargon that gets thrown around. In case you've never connected it, it was the Last Supper that Jesus ate, and it was this table that we are connected to in communion. But this also was another table that Jesus was actually sharing. I'm going to put the Gospel of Mark up on the screen. We've been walking through the Gospel of Mark for about 5 weeks now, preparing for this night. And every one of the four Gospels that's written about Jesus' life are going to converge at this point. Now, here's what's interesting. Mark 14:12. On the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" Where do you want us to go for us to engage the Passover? Now, I'm just curious, show of hands, and this is just to get you loosened up a little bit here. How many of you have had a chance to sit in on a Passover meal? Do any of you have connection, either Jewish relatives? George has got it. Yeah, a couple of you have had a chance to do this. A couple of years ago, I was amazed to discover that our Jewish brothers and sisters are still celebrating Passover, right? This is a thing that is taking place all around the world. It's actually at the same time as Easter. One of the reasons Easter is moving around all the time is that Passover is also moving around all the time following the Jewish calendar. And with Passover, what we discover is a very old and important story from Israel's past. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Israel's story as we get to why this night with Passover meant so much for Jesus and his followers. Okay? Tracking with me? So first, I want to talk to you about the lamb. The lamb. Here's what was going on with Passover. If you've ever had a chance to hear about it, see about it, hear it referenced. Passover is all about the journey that Israel went on when they were trying to get out of Egypt. I loved The Prince of Egypt growing up, that animated movie. My family often didn't let me watch explicit movies, so Charlton Heston's Ten Commandments was like PG somehow, and we would watch it all the time. So hopefully you've got a little bit of context from that. I'm not going to cover the whole story tonight. But the thing with Passover and the Exodus is that ultimately I think it's kind of interesting to go back and ask, what was really going on with these 10 plagues, these 10 signs that God does in Egypt? Have you ever wondered this? Like, why is God working through 10 different signs? Well, if you read Exodus slowly, what you'll notice is that the central contest taking place between God and the Pharaoh of Egypt is centered around the Pharaoh's heart. In fact, it says that Pharaoh repeatedly hardened his heart to God as these plagues keep going. What's interesting about that is that God is ultimately, through these signs, trying to get Pharaoh's attention and is trying to loosen up Pharaoh's heart. He's trying to actually loosen Pharaoh's grip, to release from Pharaoh the oppression, the bondage, the tight-fistedness which Pharaoh was using to control the Israelite people. So how would you go about culminating the ultimate sign to loosen up a person's heart? What we discover in the story of Exodus is that God goes directly to the thing that Pharaoh cares most dearly about. And it happens to be Pharaoh's firstborn son. So all these plagues, all these signs are happening. The 10th sign, God says to Pharaoh, if you do not release my people, then I will wipe out all firstborn sons in Egypt. Now, I realize that's a heavy thought. I don't know about you. I get a little bit of chills just sitting with God in the heaviness of this. Before you start feeling too sorry for Pharaoh, let me just, you know, we haven't talked about the whole story, and whatever animation studio did Prince of Egypt didn't always cover the more gruesome details, right? What happened in Exodus is that at the very start of the Exodus story, Pharaoh makes a decree that the Israelites are beginning to overpopulate Egypt. The Israelites are slaves, they are oppressed, they are in bondage, they are working for the Egyptians. And as Pharaoh looks out, he sees this growing, swelling, strengthening people, and out of his sort of nervousness about what this people might get up to, he tells the midwives of Israel to kill all sons born to Israelites. So they can leave the daughters can stay alive, but all of the sons need to die. This announcement would get so intense that eventually in this contest, the midwives don't do it for a little bit. Exodus is a great read, by the way. If you need something to do between now and Sunday, go back and read Exodus. The midwives don't do what Pharaoh says, and he says, that's it. Throw all the sons of Israel into the Nile River. And ironically, a son is laid in a basket, sent down the river, and it's Pharaoh's daughter who stumbles across this baby in a basket, picks it up, and says, your name shall be Moses, and we're going to adopt you into the royal family. Do you see some of the interesting themes that are starting to percolate in this story that's taking place in Egypt? Okay, so fast forward just a little bit. God is now moving towards the final sign. This is the final chance to grip Pharaoh's attention and to loosen, to open up his heart, to finally connect with him. And as God makes this announcement, I'm going to kill all the firstborn sons, he gives a somewhat strange counter-instruction to Israel. Okay, so now we are in Exodus 12, and this is what it says. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Now, this is a very old story, so this is very disconnected from what you and I are probably doing with our Good Friday. I doubt many of us slaughtered animals in order to eat at any point today. And so, again, I just want to name it. It feels strange entering in to this different era, different time. But if you can track with some of the intriguing logic here, in the ancient world, lambs were known as especially pliable, especially dependent, and especially helpless creature. So just think through your farm animals for a moment, right? Cows are not pliable. If you've ever tried to interact with a cow, they don't care what you have to say. Dogs are wonderfully pliable, and yet dogs are also a little bit crazy. They're energetic, they do what they want, they can have strong wills, they need to be potty trained. Lambs just sort of helplessly, haplessly exist. They're very pliable, they're very innocent. And so you get this sense, with a lamb especially, that when it came to choosing an animal for a sacrifice and all the sacrificial stuff going on in the ancient world, lambs were often the favorite choice because they were, in many ways, the easiest thing to sacrifice. But they also started to take on this image, this symbol of innocence, basically. Like, they didn't do anything wrong. They didn't really deserve to be here. So this animal can be used to offer up a sacrifice to whatever god you are trying to worship. God specifically instructs that Israel choose a blameless or defectless lamb under the age of one. This is a very young, very cute, very innocent creature. And then maybe the most interesting detail that I never really caught before is that God tells the Israelites to care and nurture for that lamb for 14 days. You see that? They're supposed to take care of this creature until the evening of Passover, in which they will then kill this lamb that they've been caring for. Now, that feels like a lot to me, but I can't help but notice, if you were in Israel at this time, you would care about this lamb, right? Like, you would get involved with this lamb. In fact, this lamb would be near you. You're nurturing it. It's like more close to the house than probably all the other lambs are. You're keeping an eye on it. You want to make sure that it doesn't take on defect. It doesn't get into trouble. It's young. It's innocent. And as you're caring for it, you find yourself then at a moment where you must kill it. You must take its life. You must offer it back to God. The reason why all of this matters is that when we fast forward to Jesus, I'm going to take you back to Mark now. Jesus is going to be in Mark 14 with his disciples, and he's going to tell them, this is Mark 14, 13 to 15, go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, say to the owner of the house he enters, the teacher asks, where is my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there. And then in Mark 14, 16, we find the very next verse. The disciples left, went into the city, found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. Here's why this matters, right? What the gospel writers want you to see as we approach Good Friday, as we approach what happens on the cross, is they want you to be thinking, Passover is happening. Passover is happening. There is a lamb, an innocent lamb, a lamb without defect, a lamb that should probably not be there, that at great intimacy and at great cost is about to be slaughtered so that God might pass over, might do something. Now, we're going to get to that in just a second. What I want you to see here, though, at this moment, is that everyone at this table would be thinking about that innocent lamb for the words that Jesus is about to say. Okay, so hold the lamb in your mind. We turn now to the bread. Interestingly, the Passover meal also contained a very prominent role for bread. I'm going to take you to Exodus 13:3. We're still in this Exodus story. As God has given these instructions to the Israelites, they are meant to slaughter this lamb. We're going to get into what happens with the blood and all that's going on. But essentially, the firstborn sons do die in Egypt, and the Israelites' firstborns do not. And Pharaoh finally at this point, says, go and make haste. Get out of here in a hurry. We no longer want you here with us. So something kind of interesting occurs. The Israelites have to make bread for this journey, right? They are becoming immigrants. They are being kicked out of a land of oppression, but they don't really know where they're going at this point. And so, for some reason, one of the themes that really comes out in Exodus 13, the very following chapter, is that the Israelites have to make bread in a hurry. This is what Exodus 13:3 says. Then Moses said to the people, commemorate this day, the day you came out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, because the Lord brought you out of it with a mighty hand. Eat nothing containing yeast which makes bread rise. On that day, tell your son, I do this because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. So if you've ever seen matzah bread before, which is very common at Passover, it's a yeastless bread. This is bread that's eaten in a hurry, bread that's on the journey with you. And here's why this bread matters. It matters because as Israel heads out into the wilderness, one of the first things they find is that over and over and over again, they are hungry. Israel, on their own, are hungry. And as they are wandering in the wilderness over and over and over again, Israel are going to complain. They're going to grow distressed. They're going to start telling God, maybe it was better for us if we could just get back to that slavery we once knew. Maybe, like, Egypt was better there. All we have is this crumbly, terrible bread. And yet, amazingly, God, over and over and over again, through this time in the wilderness, is going to start offering them bread. In fact, this bread starts to be called manna, and it's literally provided for them every day. We come to this Passover meal then with Jesus. He's sitting there with his friends. They're thinking about the lamb. The lamb has already been sacrificed. It's there on the table. And Jesus is going to turn to the central image of God providing. This bread is God's reminder to Israel that every day when they're out on the journey, every day when they are wandering through the wilderness, every day when life gets hard, every day when doubts start to settle in, over and over and over again, God wants to remind Israel, I will give you the bread that you need. Even if it's yeastless, even if it hasn't taken time to rise, right? This is a little bit scrappy, but here, this bread, it's everything you need. It's everything you need for the journey. Now, I wonder, as Jesus sat here at this table with this bread, if his disciples could hold all of the journeys that they would go on, right? All of the places that they would head from this moment onward. I think for us here tonight, I just am humbled thinking about this bread that God offers us. I have gone through some intense seasons in my life of struggling, of doubt. And one of the hardest seasons for me was a few years out of college where I just started to notice I could not connect with churchy things. I don't know if any of you have ever had one of these seasons where I was a little bit burned out. I'd been in the church a long time. I had hard things going on with my family. I had hard things going on with friends. Job was not working out. I mean, a lot of stuff in life was not working. And I would go to church and I would enter into the songs. And for me, I just couldn't connect. Like, I had known wonderful experiences where the songs would wash over me and I would experience this sort of mountaintop, like, tears, like connection, movement in my soul, and it wasn't happening with songs. I had sat through teachings, through sermons in churches where I just felt moved and inspired, and like their depth and profoundness was just helping me make sense of life. And for this season, every time I sat through a teaching, I was like, I am not getting anything out of this. Like, this is really not helping me. As I have looked back on this season, I've pondered it, I've wrestled with it. There's a theologian by the name of David Lindbeck who suggested that one of our problems in the American church is that we have built so much of the church experience, so much of our Sunday experience, to be very experiential. He actually calls it experiential expressivism, which is a very fancy, high-fluting term. That essentially means church is there to give us a good feeling. Church kind of becomes this thing that, like, are you low? Are you struggling? Are you having a hard time? Maybe if you go to church, you'll get to ride a high. Maybe church will take you back up there. Now, that's great, Lindbeck says, when it's working. But if you've ever had one of these seasons, it is terrible when it's not working, because every time you don't get that high, every time that song comes on and it's just not doing it for you, every time you sit through another teaching that doesn't quite connect, you're just kind of wondering, like, is God there? Is there something wrong with me? Am I ever going to get back? As I look back on that season, what I found, what I needed, was that every week I started going to a community that would do communion every week. And what I noticed was that when it came to the worship songs, like, you know, there were different ranges, dynamics. Some were better, some were worse. When it came to the teaching, some were better, some were worse. But communion was consistent. Communion only required me to show up and to cup my hands and to have somebody place bread in them. And it didn't matter to me if the bread was big or small, if it was crackers, if it was, you know, those terrible wafers we had during COVID. It didn't matter what the bread was. It just mattered that there was bread in my hands and that as I took this bread, I was able to take and eat and remember what Jesus had done for me. In this moment, I was connected to Jesus, even in a way that my mind and the sort of struggles, the valleys, the depression, all the stuff that was going on, couldn't connect to experientially. It was there. It was impossible to ignore. So Jesus in Mark 14 is going to say to his disciples while they are eating, he takes bread, and when he gives thanks, he breaks it, gives it to them, and says, "Take, eat, this is my body." Now just track, this is so deep on so many different levels. This is the matzah bread, or it's meant to be. This is the bread of manna. This is the bread from the wilderness. This is all the times God has shown up in Israel's story before, when they were distrusting, when they doubted, when they were complaining. Jesus takes that bread and he says, "This is my body. Take it and eat it." I just love that Jesus gives us something that is almost impossible to ignore, and yet that is available every single day of our lives. Maybe you don't eat bread every day, that's totally fine, but bread is everywhere, and I think that's some of Jesus's point. Jesus is offering this to you everywhere. You cannot get away from the possibility that Jesus will meet you and once again offer you this bread, this sustenance for the wilderness. Now, I'm getting to the big one. This is the final one. We turn to the blood. It just felt ominous seeing that up on the screen. It is Good Friday, so maybe you were expecting it. But I don't often get to talk about the blood, so forgive me for saying the blood too many times already. But here's why the blood matters. We're going to go to Exodus 12 one more time. We're going to complete this journey of what was happening in Passover. In the most striking moment, we find God saying, "Once this lamb has been slaughtered, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. And I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood," this is from the lamb, "will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt." It's interesting in this sign, right? Because some of the commentators want to ask, even some of the rabbis want to ask, like, did God need to see the blood? Like, was he confused? Did God not know? Was it kind of like a guessing game for God? Was the blood like, could anybody have done the blood? And I think the important thing to notice here is that the sacrifice of the animal is a sacrifice of faith, and it's also this sacrifice of involvement, isn't it? Like, the Israelites are involved. And personally, sometimes I think that sounds kind of unfair. Egypt has been oppressing Israel. This is Egypt's problem, right? Surely Egypt should be the one who has to take care of all this. They should be the ones responsible for their firstborn sons. But God says, "Israel, you are involved. Your hands are also messy, and yet I promise you, when you take this blood, it will be a sign that I promise to pass over for you." Some commentators point out that the blood had more to do with signaling to the Israelites the reminder of God's promise than it really had to do with needing God to know which house to pass over or not. But they had to get involved. There was an engagement of the heart. Israel had to show up. They had to be there. The blood had to be on their doorposts. Now, here's the deep waters. Can you come with me into a deep place for just a moment? There's this really interesting, intriguing verse in Leviticus that's going to be connected to the Passover. The verse says this in Leviticus 17:11, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by the life." Now this is, just track with me for 1 second, and if this doesn't help you, let it go. Life is in the blood. We've gotten further and further along with our science, and it's very telling today that where we like to focus on life in a human being is the mind, the brain, right? We talk about the brain a lot. There's lots of interesting stuff with brain science. Surely that's going to unlock tons of knowledge and insight, which it will. But interestingly, because I've poked around in this a little bit, The brain, though hugely important, though the central intellectual churning mechanism that does direct and guide and make all your choices and actions and behaviors, the brain cannot live without the blood. If your heart stops beating, the brain will cease to function. However, it is possible the other way. It's not enjoyable. If your brain ceases to work, as long as your heart keeps beating and blood stays in your veins, then you will still be alive. Now, the only reason that this really matters, and what's interesting about this, is that God is saying in this verse, in order for you to have life, it needs to come through the blood. Life is connected to the blood. So when blood is spilled, or when blood is offered, when a sacrifice is made, God is saying there's this deep law in the order of life in which life is offered to you through the blood. Now again, I know this is an ancient world. This is hard to get our heads around. I really like that is a parallel. There's the author C.S. Lewis who wrote The Chronicles of Narnia. And as I was thinking about this, I couldn't help but think about the lion, Aslan, if you know the stories. And Aslan is led to this table, the table of sacrifice. And the White Witch, who's this horrible villain, ends up sacrificing Aslan on this table. And the girls, Lucy and Susan, are heartbroken. And they come up afterwards, but they discover that Aslan is actually alive. And when they go to ask him what happened, like, how could this be? Aslan says, there is deep magic in the world of which the White Witch knew nothing. And I think if you can track with me, we are so focused on science. We love a good scientific principle. There is a deep principle ingrained in creation that says in order for you to receive new life, if you're going to make it, if you're going to actually find the life you wanted, if life is going to be restored to you, then it's going to need to come to you through the blood. Some blood is going to have to be spilled in order for you to receive life. Now, we return to the scene of the disciples sitting with Jesus at the Last Supper. And in Mark 14, 23, we're going to have Jesus say, as he takes a cup and gave thanks, gave it to them, and they all drank from it. Mark 14, 24, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. This is my blood. This cup, this wine, this juice is my blood being offered for you. Now, hold here. I mean, if I've just given you a taste or a glimmer for why to go back and read the book of Exodus, there are so many different themes happening at this table, aren't there? Like so many different crashing pictures as Jesus is sitting there. There is a lamb on the table. There is bread sitting in front of the disciples. And then there are these cups of wine, which everyone assumes are surely just cups of wine, right, Jesus? He instead says, no, this is going to be my blood, and this is my blood that I am going to offer to you. Kind of beautiful and even almost humorous that Jesus tells them, this is my blood, after he has them drink it. I do think the disciples would probably have been a little bit shocked and a little bit surprised, like, wait, what did we just drink? You know, like, what is happening here at this table? And that's almost the point, right? This is strange. This is deep magic. These are complex structures to how God has ordered the world. And yet, I think you're tracking with me that there is also a profound simplicity here at the table. And maybe the most moving part to me, where I want to close with us tonight, is that as we look back at Pharaoh, who lived with a hardened heart, I can't help but notice the horrifying cost God is going to require of Pharaoh is this firstborn son. How terrible, how costly. Imagine having a heart so hardened, so cut off, so self-protecting, that it's going to come at the cost of the thing you value most, your very own firstborn son. And yet, I think God goes further still in requiring that cost by saying, I will walk that cost with you. In fact, is it possible that the greatest sign God has ever given us, in an attempt to move our hearts, to break them open, to cause you even here this evening to wonder, could it be a reckless love of God? Could it be a son who came for you and for me? Could it be this love that led this son not only to this table, but all the way to that cross? Tonight, as we continue in a time of worship, we're going to have a few more songs. We're going to have servers down here at the front of the stage. Just normally we do it at the sides, but we're going to bring you forward. We're going to give you a chance to come forward and to receive this table, to receive the bread, and to receive the blood. I promise I won't call it blood on other Sundays, but tonight, I think it makes sense. Come receive this bread that is Jesus' body, which was broken for you. Come receive this cup, which Jesus says is my blood, which is shed for you so that you might have new life. Jesus, on this night, we come before you at your table. We extend our hands as we attempt to open our hearts. Lord, would you move even now in this moment, not in an experiential way, not in a soaring way, but in a humble way. Jesus, tell us as clearly as you can, when we are ready to come forward, that you have come to give in yourself for us. We lift this prayer up to you in Jesus' name. As you come forward, I would encourage you to cup your hands. We'll place the bread into it. Take a cup. You can drink it on the spot or go back to your seat. We do have gluten-free available. And I'll be up at the side if anyone would like to come forward for prayer. We'll do just a few more songs of worship here before we close.